This is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Dr. Helen Ovosu. You're an organizational psychologist, author, coach, and consultant. And I want to welcome you to the Phantom Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm so happy to be with you today. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's always great to talk to new people all the time. A couple of things we want to talk about before we start is we are a featured podcast on the Newsly platform. You might see that icon says listen on Newsly, and scrolling below is a coupon code that everybody who's watching or listening, if you use that coupon code at Ghost, you can check out Newsly for 1 month. That's an audio only platform, and later today we'll be on that platform as a featured podcast, and so you can check that out. We also have the resilientcareer.com as your link that will be fully clickable for everybody. Once we're fully published, we are on all the major podcast platforms. As I indicated, we're live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch right now, and that will be clickable once we're done with the show. So you won't have to remember that, but that link is up there.
Terrific. Thanks.
Thank you. And one of the first questions you always ask any guest that comes on the show is, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Well, I'm motivated by a lot of things, but I think the thing that has me going and engaged in terms of my services is that time after time, I've seen not only for myself, but so many other people who are hardworking and experienced and qualified, but somehow haven't gained the traction that they should have in their career. So I thought to myself, you know what? I have some insights and some skills that I can offer. And yeah, of course, I could have focused on the Fortune 500, but I'm focusing on other people who feel like my people, who are trying to get ahead, whether they have their own small business or they are trying to, you know, make the most out of their own skills and abilities as in their own careers. So that's really what's driving me. I feel like a bit of a, who's that one? Robin Hood, not really taking from the poor, but democratizing certain things.
Yeah. I think that's real important, you know, because we can see we're both here in the minority group, you know, classification. You know, I'm an African-American, you know, guy that works in my day job in the software industry, and I don't see a lot of people look like me. And I've been in that industry for a long time, and there seems to be, you know, I've been in since 1990, and okay. I have not seen a big increase in people who look like me in the industry since then. You know, I'm usually one of two people in the room that look like me.
Well, we have that in common. In psychology in Canada, we have the exact same dynamic. I started in 1999, so a little bit after you. But it's rare that I've ever had even one other Black person in a workplace with me.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of barriers. And I understand it because, you know, I was lucky. I went to a really good school. Okay. I went to like a Bowdoin College, which is a known small kind of Ivy League school in America. Okay. And it gave me a leg up. And then also, I just think you have to have a certain drive. My father was an insurance sales manager and agent. And he had a big drive. And one of the first things he ever did is he put us in the suburbs because he understood that if we got to go to the school that the kids in the suburbs go to, we would have a chance of being able to go to schools. My brother went to Harvard and Brown. Okay. But because he understood the way schooling system in America was set up. So he put us in a place, but it was hard because there's no other Black kids in my neighborhood. Right. So I was isolated in that way, but that's not how most Black people, you know, live. And so there's big barriers.
So that's another overlap that we have. I grew up in the suburbs. My brother and I were usually the only Black kids in our classes. There might have been two or three other Black families in those schools. But, you know, it created certain opportunities for us, for sure. Isolation, so there's that downside, but also a very clear upside.
Yeah, that's a hard thing. It's like, how do you, you know, it's hard to transfer that experience to a lot of, you know, the atypical Black person living in America, if they're not in that kind of zone, if they don't have those advantages or so-called somewhat disadvantages culturally, you know, it's hard to get that leg up.
That's
because
it.
The system seems to be kind of designed to not really lift you up.
Well, so, that's it. And this reminds me of earned privileges and unearned privileges. So both of us were very fortunate to have been born into families where we had certain advantages from the get-go. But we also did our part, right? We've become educated and been able to leverage that going forward.
Yeah, and there's a whole thing like in the community in America where a lot of times if you tend to go toward like, you know, the Booker T. Washington or the W.E. Du Bois point of views, right? So if you go to like, well, I'm going to go to all black college or I'm going to go to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can get to a place, but what I've seen is like a lot of black entrepreneurs, they actually did it. There's more of them that are coming from the black college system in America than are coming from the Bowdoins and the Browns and stuff.
Okay.
There's like more people who actually decide to come up that way. I'm just wondering the kind of psychology of that. Maybe it's different experiences, but it seems like as if you come through something like I'm saying, like the Negro College Fund and the traditionally mm-hmm. black college culture, there seems to be a different outcome.
Well, we don't have any of those historically black colleges or universities in Canada, but I think because my mother is Jamaican and my father's from Ghana, they had a lot of, well, obviously black families, but part of their immigrant experience was that they kept in touch with a lot of people from those countries. So growing up, I had that in my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, when you talk about career psychologist and career psychology, maybe you can kind of talk about like the difference. Are they the same as therapy, or maybe you can define what those are?
Well, it's actually a term that I pretty much made up. I mean, and I do it partly so that it's a good way to distinguish myself from what the clinical and therapeutic people do. So I focus on things like career development, leadership, some HR issues. All of these things are helpful for people who want to make the most of their own skills and abilities and be successful in their careers. So that could include things like, on the career side explicitly, it could include things like figuring out what kinds of professional development to pursue, figuring out how best to show up in an interview. So interview prep, even taking a step before interview prep, even things like resumes and cover letters being crafted in a way that makes you kind of stand out to kind of highlight your uniqueness rather than blending in like all the other applicants.
That's interesting. Because today we've got another layer that I've been running into is the AI screening of resumes. So there's a point in time where, you know, there was some computer control reviewing algorithms that were reviewing resumes, but now there's definitely, there are AI processes that are screening resumes. And there's certain things that are getting, like, they're just getting thrown out if the AI doesn't see certain things.
Well, there's absolutely that whole keyword piece. Yeah, that part is fascinating. But I'm also noticing another trend with AI. So obviously the AI algorithms are using the data that's existing from before 2022 in particular. But the problem is that many of the people who have gone through certain selection processes and been selected, been hired, are not very diverse. So the system is kind of stacked to replicate what's happened in the past, not necessarily giving everyone an opportunity who actually does have the skills and abilities.
Yeah, that's a big problem in IT, because if you look at Silicon Valley, it doesn't look like me and you.
No.
And then when people build those AI models and when they build the AI learning structures, they're coming from a bias, whether they know it or not. And so when systems are not just built without that feature. When people have an inherent bias that they don't understand, they build it into their tech. And so a lot of people in tech today, we're really kind of upset that, you know, there's not enough people in the room making those decisions about what that algorithm is going to look at or how the learning is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Those things are kind of putting us a bunch of steps behind.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know how that's going to be fixed, because it looks like the train has left the station.
Yeah.
Right. People are already using the ChatGPT and the GPT-4. So the learning is ongoing.
Yeah, it's like what you have to do is that human element when you get to the face-to-face interview. And that's probably where I think talking to a person like you is going to really help somebody. Like, if they learn how to present, right? Mm-hmm. How to actually, you know, when you're dealing with the recruiters and those HR interviews, how you present yourself, like, you know, what you did beyond the algorithm. When you get in touch with people, how are you going to deal with the questions? How are you going to deal with open-ended questions? How are you going to deal with, like, what's your biggest failure in your career? How do you answer that when they ask you that?
Absolutely. You know, like that. Especially when there's a time limit.
Yeah. Like, how do you learn how to do an elevator pitch? How do you present the best? You know, you have a 20, if you're somebody I've run into, people who've been around a while, 20 years worth of jobs on your resume. How do you redefine that to push what they're looking for? Because everybody so wants something like very edited today. And then you're like, well, I want to show my breadth of my experience. But how do you like learn to focus and learn to actually be clear and concise and win that moment?
Absolutely. And that's not something you can do in real time during the interview. You need to have thought it through in advance.
Yeah, that's a hard thing, because I think a lot of people don't know what they don't know. It's like, so it's like, how do you put yourself in the best possible position when you're under the fire? You know, it's like.
Yeah, I think one basic takeaway is to consider what's in the job posting and try to have reflected on the things that they need from you and how your past experience lines up with that.
Because somebody will tend to go sequential. And sometimes, like, if you read what the job is and you did something for 20 years, right? Maybe there's there's an example, like, what if you worked in Japan? Right. And they say they want somebody international, but that's like 5 years back in your resume. Mm-hmm. So you got to learn to push that up. Yeah, it's like, you push up the things that they're looking for, you know, right away.
And another hint is to always actually say the thing. Sometimes we want to be diplomatic and kind of talk around something, but depending on who's interviewing you, you really need to be very explicit. Because not everybody will give you the benefit of the doubt. They kind of often need to focus on what you actually said, not what they can assume you meant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're more, like, be very explicit, and also, you know, don't be passive. You know, kind of be active, like, I did do this, or, you know, I don't think I can. Like, make sure that you're very direct and talk about your actual experience and why you're going to be a good choice for them. And you kind of got to own it. You can't come in with like imposter syndrome. You've got to come in being very, not that you're arrogant, but you're self-confident, right?
Absolutely. And you raise a good point. This imposter syndrome, it tricks certain people into not even applying for certain positions. Right? If you don't think you're good enough, sometimes you screen yourself out.
Yeah, a lot of times there are jobs. I've seen people in the industry, I've been in the industry for a while, that will actually go for jobs where they don't exactly have the qualifications, but they believe them in themselves that, oh, I could learn that, or I can take this experience and actually show how it applies. So a lot of people, like you say, they won't even apply because, oh, I don't have this. It's like in IT, there's so many technologies where how many people actually know how to do AI, you know, transformational work. It's just happening. So you couldn't have 5 years of that.
Exactly.
So it doesn't mean that you can't apply for it, because if you've been in tech for 20 years, you could go and apply and get in it. And so, but a lot of people say, well, I don't have it, I got to go get a certificate. You could figure out, read about it, do some research, and find the things that could link to showing that you could do this. Because maybe you learned blockchain, maybe you learned other things that didn't exist before. So why couldn't you learn it? So, you know, if you stop yourself, because you say, there's a lot of people that are very bold, you know, this, yeah, I can do that. And they kind of sell themselves and into the role. And they never did it.
And the truth is that with some of these emerging technologies, they're so new that there aren't that many places you can get an official designation. So if you understand how to leverage it, explain how you use it, explain what you can do with it. And don't worry about a degree program in something, because I'm not even sure if there are that many degree programs explicitly in AI.
They're just starting to happen. So most of the people in it just happen to be lucky that they were working at ChatGPT or they're working at IBM and they were on it. Right? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other people, they never done it. And it's like, if you are somebody that always learns, like if you're the type of person that you go and you like to learn, and you're kind of like the person that's going to get the PhD or is going to get the master's program, is going to continue, even if you don't have those things, like, you could just be somebody that always wants to learn the newest thing on the block. And if you've gone and done it and shown that you have a ability to go from the next trend and learn how to use the tools, like the artist that learned how to use, all the different art tools rather than just doing the inks, actually using Adobe, right? Yeah. And my daughter is a young artist, so she can do inks and pastels, but she can use Adobe and she can use all the tools. Mm-hmm. There are some artists that never learn how to use those tools, and well, you kind of got it going. That's the way the world's going now. You can't just be in one lane. You have to go into multiple lanes.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm not even so fussy on official designations. Next week, I'm actually sitting down with the guy who takes care of my website. And he's got a background in computer science, and he's very strong, self-taught in AI. And he's going to be helping me become more nuanced with my GPT-4.
Well, yeah. It sometimes, like, a lot of people that get into tech, some of the guys who built, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, they didn't have the certifications. They just had the curiosity, be like inventor-like mindset. There's a lot of people that don't have degrees that get into stuff. You know, I'm a musician, and you look at guys like Prince and Hendrix. They never went to Berkeley, but they're one of the most innovative artists that you've ever seen. And they didn't learn music theory. They just kind of are music theory.
Nice.
So you don't have to necessarily, in music, it's very common. You talk to bluesmen and a lot of jazz people, a lot of the, hip hop. It was invented kind of just by people who didn't have credentials. They just felt it and they did it. Because it was something they loved, and they did, there's a passion, and that can apply to non-musicians. There's anybody who's a creative that has to work that way. And sometimes those people can't be measured on the bell curve because they're kind of in the extremes. So if you try to test them on a standardized test, they don't actually show their real ability.
And that's another good point. There are so many different types of intelligence. I'm not so sure that most schools test for musical intelligence, athletic intelligence, creative intelligence. They focus on book learning. And frankly, I don't know, book learning has its place, but when AI gets a hold of things, I think people who know how to use it will be able to pretend that they are very knowledgeable because they have access to the collective knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things are, stream of consciousness or being in a flow state. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a lot of things that are not sequential, right? If you get in a mindset where you're not worth thinking sequentially, you kind of bouncing around. There's a lot of really powerful stuff that comes out of that. But a lot of times that people who are going through the kind of standard learning, they don't know how to do that. Like, I run into people that are classically trained musicians and they can't do fusion, improvisational jazz because they're looking to know what the next thing is. Well, you gotta feel it. You gotta have the muse. You gotta be in the flow state. You gotta accept it and not be kind of having all these conditions about it. You gotta learn how to be in it. And that's hard to explain to people if they can't do it.
Difference between scripted and improv.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a method actor versus somebody who's going by the script and he actually does a better job than what the writer wrote for the scene.
Mm.
Because he became the character. He read the character so much, he actually becomes the character more than what the writer wrote. You know, it can happen. So, I mean, sometimes that happens and certain people can feel that. I think a lot of human beings can actually do it, but they might not believe they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they stop themselves. Like you said, you don't apply for the job because you don't think you can do it. So you just put all these glass ceilings.
So I'm curious, what kind of music do you create?
Experimental music that I call expansive sound. It crosses multiple genres. So I do like fusion, funk, new wave, hip hop. It's all kind of punk, you know, rock. I'm in my studio right now. It's all my stuff, but I kind of feel it. And I use a lot of, I'm a keyboardist. I'm a synthesist. I have a lot of modular analog gear. It's all kind of old school. Like a lot of kids today, they're in the box. They're on a computer. I got a Moog and a Roland and a Yamaha.
Okay.
I got modular synths from the 1970s, and I actually make my sounds. So I'm more into kind of sound design and kind of newfound sound creation, which is this idea is like you let the muse come in and you work on your keyboard or your piano and you put the tape player on and you let it happen. Then you go back and listen and say, oh, here's a nugget. And then you start to build on things.
Okay.
And it's kind of like a poet that just opens the page and just starts writing, or an author that gets on a typewriter, starts typing, gets in that flow state. It's that kind of thing.
Neat.
It's a different way of doing things. You know, some people can't really get into that because they want to know what the next step is. They want to go do it on the paper, go into the bars and actually map out all the chord changes, map out all the melodies and the choruses and move things. Not that I can't do that, but I find that sometimes when I do that, the stuff that I do off the hook or off the cuff actually sounds better than that.
Okay.
And you come to a realization that your kind of muse flow state actually does a better job of that than when you're trying to be too tight. You understand what I'm saying?
I can imagine it, but I'm not musical enough to be able to reproduce it.
yeah, but it can happen in a lot of things. Like if you figure out like what you're going to do, if you're a public speaker, like if they had an example, like you had a teleprompter and you had a preset speech, and then you read the room and you see what you wrote isn't working. So then you start to realize like, I've got to kind of pay attention to this moment and adjust.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that type of thing.
Great analogy. That one I can totally relate to.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people can do that. You're like once you've learned, you know, you do something enough, you'll start to read the room. You can read who's there. And so I think that's part of the process. But you wrote a book about the processes you're doing for the challenges of the modern workplace. So maybe you can talk about, that's a very creative process in terms of like, how did you go about writing that book?
Well, I was coming up on a work anniversary and I was kind of thinking, well, you know, what have I done? What are things that kind of seem to be resonating with my clients? And I basically identified the 10 big challenges that usually compel people to call me, usually because there's something happening at work that's hard or maybe even scary. And it's not the kind of thing that they can just do a Google search and find the answer. So I had all these ideas, but I wasn't sure how to put it together in a way that would be relatable and simple and interesting. So I actually was very lucky. I found the book editor, somebody in Washington, D.C., and I came to him with my ideas. And over a course of a couple of online brainstorming sessions, came up with a way to sort of organize these ideas. And then I went back and actually put together the first draft. He read it, had some notes to kind of shuffle things a little further. I went back and filled it in a little bit more. And basically that was the first full manuscript. So covering things like dealing with toxic workplaces where maybe the environment is maybe cutthroat, or there's some cruelty or incivility, biases, of course, discrimination. This was post George Floyd. So all of the experiences of being the only one or one of few in a workplace, whether it's because of your skin color or you're being a religious minority, somebody who's differently abled, neurodiverse, all those kinds of things. Of course, imposter syndrome. So I think those are some of the key chapters. Is that giving you a good sense?
Yeah, that's the title of the book. Yeah, it's a very good sense. But your title of your book, again, is it How to Be Resilient in Your Career Facing Up to Barriers at Work?
That's correct. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about doing certain things up front as your career is unfolding, so that if you encounter some bumps on the road or some setbacks, hopefully you've got enough good fundamentals in place that you can bounce back a lot quicker or even avoid certain problems in the first place.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of pitfalls because there's certain ideologies out there are making things very difficult. One of the things is, like, you know, diversity and inclusion has now become like a bad acronym. You know, to certain people, they go and say DEI, and it's kind of like they're trying to tag you. And, you know, previously you said, well, what's wrong with that, right? But now if they say it, they actually have a very negative connotation tied to it. So then anybody who gets tagged with that, then they try to act like everything you've done is not legitimate, right? And somehow you're not supposed to be where you are.
Well, one thing I like to think about is that in psychology, we have this thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And one of the basic things that most humans like to feel comfortable and to feel productive and to feel well is a sense of belonging. And so a lot of, you know, at its base, equity, diversity, and inclusion is really about creating a workplace or an environment in general where everybody can belong. You don't have to be a specific gender. You don't have to be a specific skin color. You don't have to be neurotypical. You don't have to have one religion. Anyone has value and should be able to contribute. And so when you come at it at that angle, well, anyone who's against that wants certain people to be excluded.
Yeah, it's an exclusionary game, you know, because they're kind of going back into the politics we have in the U.S. right now is very old school. Yeah. It's going to this point where, like, well, we like things the way they used to be. Well, you know, before 1964, then I wasn't at the table.
Well, that's it. People like us knew our place, so to speak.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah. Is that what you mean? It makes it great again. If I'm not able to do X, Y, Z, then you are happy. Well, we can't really accept that. No. And so that's a bad premise because it's not logical. It's just like you have a point of view that doesn't fit the world. The world is very diverse. You know, and so if you want to have a certain set aside, well, that's kind of anti-competitive.
But the truth is, there's always been a set aside, right? Everything was set aside for people who were a specific gender, a specific color, a specific religion, specific kind of ability. So there's always been a set aside. Now we're kind of trying to get away from the set aside so that everybody who's able can contribute.
It's funny, though. They're trying to act like the diversity and inclusion is a set aside.
I know.
So it's like we have to make an argument to kind of counter their reality. And so people have this kind of, and it's, I'm going to get into the psychology of it. I took a little, you know, Nietzsche and Sartre, but you're like, if you have these frameworks and you basically say the sky is purple when it's blue and you get people to believe it's purple. And so like, so that's what seems to be going on. It's like you redefine the reality in the terms that you want it to be. And then you try to legislate it and codify it and put it into the social mores and structure it. And I think that's what we're kind of dealing with, right?
That's exactly what we're doing. Have you watched that movie Origin or read the book called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontent?
I think my daughter showed me it and I was watching something mm-hmm. on it. I haven't read it, but I think I saw some video version of that.
Well, a big part of it is that, you know, in North America, well, pretty much globally, but especially in North America, we've had a system where in order to justify the enslavement of certain people, they had to make up all kinds of lies about those people.
Yeah.
Right? Because without those lies and without that justification, none of it would have worked. Right? Yeah. Because regular, decent people don't treat other people worse than they treat animals.
Yeah, well, when you use like religion, say we're the sons of Cain, then the three-fifths of a human and the Constitution, and you never amend it. Yeah. So there's some structural things. Like if you have the sons of Cain, and then you have the three-fifths of a person in the Constitution, and then you never get rid of that, right? You never amend that. And then you create, like, you know, the Civil Rights Act, not as a law, not as, you know, as a law, but not as an amendment to the Constitution, so it can be knocked down.
Mm-hmm.
So we have things that are like these temporary fixes, and then we have these permanent structural, you know, kind of racially not diverse concepts that are codified in canons. You know, you get these things that are codified in the Bible, codified in the Constitution, and then, well, you know, that must be the way it is.
Well, when that's all you've ever seen, some people believe that is the way it should be. Of course.
Yeah, it's hard. And then when you challenge it, it's like, well, you know, we're actually trying to get it back to the way it should be. And that's why we're living within this kind of age, is there's people who are trying to exclude people from, like, you know, sexual, you know, because of your gender, because of your race, because of, like, your ethnicity, you should be excluded. And then they think it's justified. And so then, like, if you try to go based on your ability, they're saying, well, that doesn't matter. It's like,
well, that's what
was supposed to matter.
But the truth is, I suspect that some people don't want it to be a fair competition because maybe they haven't really earned their place.
Oh, yeah. That's right? The problem.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times if you look at people who are in leadership and management roles, sometimes they just get it because of seniority, not because they actually have capability. If you have these seniority-based systems, they're not based on whether or not you really can do it, but based on how long you've been there.
Yeah.
Like the U.S. Congress and stuff that way. So people get to be a leader of a committee just because they were there the longest, not the means that they actually know what they're doing or they actually understand the topic. And then you have structures like that in corporate worlds too. So somebody gets promoted on the system, not because, and then sometimes they get put into a role they probably should never be in. Like, what if you were like an architect and you get put into it to be a CFO? But you don't know nothing to do with being a chief financial officer. You're a structural designer, but you get put in that role because that's the position to be in. But then you get these people in mismatched roles that don't really, but they believe they deserve it. But then people who actually have the skill set to have it don't get to be there.
Well, there's that, and there's a lot of nepotism and cronyism where people get opportunities because of you know, because they're friends or close to somebody.
Yeah,
and I get it. We like to do favors for people who we know, like, and trust. And sometimes it works out, but sometimes it creates problems and unfairness.
Yeah. It's like golf course, and you're in the Chamber of Commerce, and you know everybody in there, and they're kind of like companies that have been there. Like, if you're in the Chamber of Commerce on Main Street, you gotta been there 50 years, the new kid on the block's not gonna get the shot that the guys have been there 50 years. They're gonna get the best. And they're all on the golf course. They're all in the special, they're at the country club. So they get the privilege. And it's not anything to do with, but then other people get measured on, oh, you gotta have the highest test score, you gotta have this certificate. When if you look at the other people on the other side of the room, they don't have any of that.
Correct. So it's a lot to navigate.
Yeah, I mean, you can't give up. You know, you have to keep up pushing. And some people give up because they think it's stacked. And it is stacked, but that doesn't mean you don't try. So I guess
you need to at least learn the rules so that you can play the rules more effectively, because some people don't know the rules and they get frustrated because they're not successful. I mean, there's bias as well, but you also need to know the rules or else it's too hard.
Well, you can find different ways to approach things, right? So if you, like, I used to have this problem where I would do interviews and then I'd show up and they'd be looking for me because they couldn't. They're like, they didn't expect from my voice that I looked like the way I did. Yeah. And he was like, where's Mr. Jones? He's like, I'm standing right there, the only guy in the room. He's like, I'm Mr. Jones. And they're going, oh. Yeah. Then the world has shifted in some ways in my tech is I can work from home now a lot. There's a lot of things. And what I've found for me is I've been more successful working remotely as a consultant within IT than playing the game as a guy who is trying to work his way through the promotional structure within one company. But to be a consultant and managing and consulting with multiple companies, Fortune 500 companies, I've been able to find a way to navigate to be successful on my terms, which, you know, changing the game. It's like, maybe I don't need to be successful the way they look at it. I need to be as successful the way I want to look at it.
But also, you know, I think part of what you're getting at is that sometimes when you work in an organization and you're a very high performer, there are all kinds of other things that are happening that prevents you from just being a high performer. So if you can find a new role where you're rewarded for being extraordinary, you're the happiest person ever, right? Because now none of your clients are going to get jealous or salty because you're giving them amazing value for money. They love it.
Yeah.
But if you were doing that same excellence in another organization, people would be, you know, they'd have like dagger eyes on you. They'd be sabotaging you. They'd be trying to undermine you so that they could look better relative to you.
I think it's a comfort level because some people want to be in the same place at the same company for 20 years. And they get a fear of being in the consultant role because it's like, you know, 6 months here, year here, 2 years here, 5 months here, 3 months here. It's like, and they want to know that they're going to the same place all the time. But you know what? Sometimes when you take ownership and you decide I'm going to be like an entrepreneur, I'm going to run my own thing or do things like kind of independently, you have to trust that you'll continue to get the gigs, right? That you continue to get the work. And sometimes that's a hard thing for somebody to accept and they won't go that way. But I think the Great Resignation seemed to show that a lot of people started to say, hey, yeah, I don't want to be in a box anymore. I want to do it my way.
And also, you know, sometimes people are scared to move away from that every 2 weeks or every month, that direct deposit hit in their bank account, not realizing that maybe in some respects that's actually more risky because you have one source of income. Whereas if you are an entrepreneur, you have multiple clients, all of them aren't going to drop you at once, especially if you're delivering consistent, terrific value for money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the other piece And the other piece I like to think about in terms of self-employment versus having a job, it's kind of analogous to renting a house and owning a house. Yes, if you are renting a house, there's lots of advantages. You can call a landlord when things go badly, but you're not building equity, right? And in some organizations, when you become very experienced, your income keeps increasing. And at some point, maybe you're too expensive. So they want to just, let you go. Maybe with severance and bring in someone who's good enough. Whereas, and so in a sense, you're not really building equity in your career. Whereas if it's your own thing, you're building your own brand, you're building reserve revenue. And anyway, don't need to get us off track.
No, it makes a lot of sense because the modern workplace can be very, trauma inducing. You got a lot of people who have PTSD from their experience in the Fortune 500 because it's very toxic type of, management styles. You get these top down, very bully-like behavior. What I've seen, I've seen very much high school-like behavior, like frat boy-like behavior. And I've been in a frat. And what I've seen is the stuff when I was going to getting my BA, my bachelor's degree, I see people behaving in corporate America the same way they were acting like in the frat house when I was in college. And what is that?
Well, personally, I think it's a failure of leadership because at the end of the day, most organizations exist to deliver products and services. And when you have certain people who cannot focus on doing their work, because they have to focus on protecting themselves, all of a sudden, instead of paying people 100% of their income and letting them just focus on doing that work, 20%, 30% of that income is kind of lost because that's how much of their energy is being drawn into survival and self-protection. So that's why I think it really is a failure of leadership when people just ignore the harmful things that are happening to people at work, whether it's classic bullying or more identity-based mistreatment.
How do you get the leaders to become more trauma-informed? Are they open to reading your book and consulting with people like you and starting to actually, do some analysis of what, the situation that they have created within their workplaces?
Some are. I mean, I'm sure lots of them aren't, right? All those folks who think EDI is woke and it's terrible. Well, those ones, maybe we can't convince them. But I remember seeing a big study published by Deloitte and another report that was similar in the Harvard Business Review talking about the impact of toxic and counterproductive behaviors at work. I mean, it really impacts the bottom line. And the truth is that whether it's mistreatment from bullying or mistreatment from discrimination or exclusion, it's still mistreatment. All of it is creating these small T traumas that when you add them up, it's the same impact as a big T trauma. So when leaders who actually want to improve their productivity of their organization, want to improve their bottom line, when they understand the link between their workplace culture and their bottom line, then they realize, okay, there's something here.
Yeah, because I've read that racism affects the GDP of the nation, and so if you take it down to the microcosm of each corporation, that's affecting the bottom line of every organization. So absolutely, they might be looking at it the other way because they're saying, well, if I have to have this diversity vice president making decisions, I'm thinking that's messing up my productivity. That's messing up my quality control. And they make these assumptions. So there's a lot of assumptions. Oh, well, the Boeing situation is because of diversity and inclusion, because they put people on the floor there. And then they come to find out that when you do really deep analysis, they got engineers out of the decision making. They got bean counters in the C-suite to start cutting cost in an engineering firm that took engineering very seriously. But then these bean counters came in and said, well, that's quality control. That's not important. That's cutting the profitability. But they didn't see the big picture. An airplane has to be like zero defect level, like Japanese level thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have very high level. You got to have an engineer in the room when you're cutting things and say, can you really cut that and safely operate that plane? You can't just have an accountant and the CPA make that decision.
Now, it's almost tax season in Canada, so I do believe that accountants have a good role, but they need to be involved in the right thing.
Some situations, you can't lower the quality, like, you know, in healthcare. No. You know, you can't have a bean counter instead of like an actual scientist level doctor that understands biology. And like, if you cut corners with this formula, you could hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes things like safety has to be important. And I saw this engineer saying safety has to come back into corporate America overall. And it seems like safety in terms of people, because that's in terms of like the product. But creating a safe workspace is just as important, and making that sure the product is safe.
And you raise an interesting point. You know, within health and safety, we know that most organizations and industries are regulated in terms of, you know, making sure that restaurants aren't going to create unsafe food that creates food poisoning. Gyms and spas, those are monitored to make sure people are not getting sick from those environments too. But the truth is, people usually recover from those things. So I'm not saying diminish that, mm-hmm. but I do want to imagine what would happen if, from a health and safety perspective, somebody was making sure that there was some kind of an audit to make sure that people are not being hurt emotionally and psychologically at work. Because those things, that takes longer to recover from, right? If you've been bullied mercilessly or discriminated against because of your identity, things that you can't even change and that have no impact on your ability to do your work, those things, those have a way of staying with you. So yeah. It's kind of ironic that more dangerous things are ignored.
Yeah, it's just because they're not quantifying, but like you said, it's affecting GDP and it's affecting the profitability of the company, but they're not measuring it right because they're looking at the numbers in the wrong way. And they're actually not really assessing the true impact, and they need, you know, psychologists and sociologists and people to actually, you know, not just work with the economists, like figure out from those types of sciences how to run the measurements and actually take it serious. And, you know, a lot of times they'd be people look at that and like, oh, food, I'm not going to go into that because that's not the real money. But, you know, it is the real money.
It is the real money. Yeah. I mean, if you lose 30% of somebody's efforts because of the distraction associated with mistreatment, that might make the big difference between profitability and failure.
Yeah, you wonder why you're failing. Like you get these industries failing. And then, you know, there's sometimes if you get, you know, the leadership, the things, the people are just interchangeable. Yeah. That they're not valuable. That they don't, that you can just grab anybody and replace anybody without understanding the human factor. That's a big mistake.
And some people get something else confused. They may think, well, sure, so-and-so is a real a-hole, a real pain in the butt, but they're very productive. They always hit their numbers, or they're very knowledgeable. But the truth is, when you look at the ripple effect that one person has that's triggering other people to quit, which is very expensive for organizations to be forever recruiting and onboarding and then losing people. When you look at the impact of people who are distracted and they're at work, but unable to really focus because of what's being done to them by these people, right? They call it the presenteeism. Well, you start to realize that person actually isn't a great value. They may be, you know, they may have like a 10% bump on what other people bring in, but the losses that person's creating indirectly or even directly is worse than whatever they're bringing in.
You know, because sometimes we have examples of, they get a toxic boss and they're causing massive turnover with like the staff. So they keep them and they never get rid of them. But then there's like on a project team of 20 people, they're causing turnover of like 50% of the team on a project. And then the project's date is supposed to get done in 12 months. It gets pushed out to 18 months. Then it gets pushed out to 24 months. Well, that part that you're not getting, you're the people that that person is driving away. The problem is not those people. The problem is the person that drove those people away. And the problem is management tends to look, oh, those people must have been causing the problem. It's like, why don't you look at who's really causing the
problem? Yeah. So again, a failure of leadership.
Yeah, it's very common. I mean, you can run into it because they just, oh, well, we know him or we know them. And, you know, they're on the golf course or they're in the room and they've known him for 20 years. It's like, sometimes that relationship is really not as valuable as you think it is. And, you know, getting people to understand that, you know, like you said, if there are people who are not open to it, then you've got a brick wall. But if you get people who are willing to listen to this kind of conversation, they're willing to entertain trying to look at different metrics, trying to understand different ways of looking at things and understand the way human beings sometimes work in different ways.
And the truth is, there is research out there that backs up what we're talking about. Dr. Adam Grant, he's an organizational psychologist like me. He teaches at the Wharton Business School. He has data that says it's better to leave roles empty than to fill it with the wrong person who creates all this turmoil around them. And Deloitte has research about the impact of what happens to people when they feel that they need to downplay or cover up parts of themselves at work that they don't feel are welcome. It's in the HBR, and it's been studied and published by Deloitte. So it's out there. It's just not popular.
Yeah, because, you know, you get people that, like I said, they kind of give it the foo-foo term. And so that's new age thinking. And they want to bottom line it. And it's like, I'm just about looking at the red and, you know, getting it back in the black. And not really looking at human beings as human beings. They like, yeah, they think of them like a widget. If you look at people as like just on the assembly line, they're like the robot on the assembly line building the car. And you don't think you have to understand, you just direct that robot to be as fast and as efficient and not give you any problems. But the thing is, the human being, it's not that they're giving you problems. They might be giving you feedback. They might be coming up with ideas. They might be telling you something. The robot's just going to do what you tell it to do. It's not going to give you something that could add value with a human mind, because it doesn't have a human mind.
And this kind of relates back to some of my thoughts about AI. There are lots of things that are kind of mechanical or predictable or can be learned, but information isn't everything. There are certain things that require, you know, that human aspect, you know, the relationships, the empathy, the humanity to pull certain things together and to deliver. It may be a while before people rely on robots to babysit their children or to educate their children.
It's kind of like the happy accident. Yeah. I mean, the happy accident comes from the fact that human beings are not perfect. And a lot of things happen from like the fact that something that's imperfect actually could end up being a big asset. So a lot of times you might have a task, and as a human being, you actually see a different result. And then if you're not scared, if your environment doesn't have a lot of fear, you might actually go and show, hey, this is actually better than what we were supposed to be doing. And then you actually get something innovative And innovation tends to happen from unexpected results. And scientists run into this all the time, but ITP, all kinds of people, you know, artisans that are building cars, you know, hand building cars, they used to find different ways of doing things and different things that were actually more effective. And so if you just keep on doing the same thing over and over, you never get any change except from the top. But if you start to take from the floor, the people, and actually trust them, they will give you all kinds of ideas that will help you. Mm-hmm. But if you think that everything coming to the floor is like, well, they're just on the floor, they're not at my level, then you're never going to get it. Yeah. Which, you know, there's, I think a lot of people on the floor get a lot of trauma when they don't feel that they're being listened to. And then they might just leave for the money, right? To a place that will pay them $10 more.
If they're being mistreated.
Yeah. Or you know, they just got to leave because it's a toxic environment. Mm. So then you keep on getting this turnover. You don't learn anything. So that to me is like, if you can actually listen, and it's a listening skill. It's like, how can you get people to open up enough to accept the feedback?
And that requires some trust, and that doesn't really happen in certain environments.
Yeah, because I mean, workplace inclusion is really about trusting that diversity. You know, trusting that diversity that it will be a good experience. But if you presuppose it, that that's always a bad experience, that's not going to be a good result, then you're never going to want to, you know, embrace it. So that's kind of, maybe you want to tell us about maybe a lesson learned from everything you've done. Maybe are there three major lessons learned from either doing the book or the work you've done over the years that you think the audience would appreciate?
Well, one big lesson is that when you know what you are about and what you're capable of, you should hold on to that and find ways to demonstrate it. And if you can't demonstrate it in your day job, try to demonstrate it elsewhere so that you can keep in mind that you are capable despite some of the things that may be happening around you. Another one, even if you can tolerate being mistreated for whatever reason, it's not a good idea. Not only does it feel bad in terms of your psychology, in terms of your mental well-being, it has a way of impacting your physical health as well. And that's why a lot of people who are dealing with a lot of oppression also seem to have some chronic diseases, cardiovascular, neuroendocrine, metabolic. So I do think that we really should pay attention to how we feel in certain environments. And if it feels bad, we need to do what we can to find a replacement job where we don't have to feel terrible. And then another piece, and this one's kind of general for almost anybody. Yeah. If I look back on my career, the 20 something years, everybody who I know who's very successful, it's not that they were always the absolute best at something or the absolute smartest. They had the best relationships. So I think most of us need to figure out ways to create better networks and better relationships and not rely only on being the best or the smartest.
Oh, that's a really interesting point, because we're kind of in this age of everybody wanting their credentials and wanting to know that you're like, you have that experience. But you're saying that, going back to a human aspect of communication, is the core of humanity, you know?
I think it is.
And being able to have a relationship at work, at home, outside of home, that's what makes us, you know, you kind of have the glue that makes everything work. But, you know, we've been kind of told individuals can just stand alone without any kind of help. and this idea that you could just do it all by yourself. And I think that's been kind of self-destructive, or like even societally destructive, without thinking about the connections where you kind of need to work as a team.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's kind of that myth of merit being what drives everything. I'm not saying merit doesn't matter. I'm not saying qualifications don't matter. But when most of us ask around to find an accountant, a dentist, a lawyer, all these people have the same credentials on paper. But some of them are a lot more effective at using what they know. And it's usually a combination of interpersonal skills, communication skills, judgment, initiative, all kinds of soft skills that really contribute to the quality of people's relationships.
Yeah,
and how well they can do their work.
Yeah, because if you have an accountant that's like technically the best, but they're a real bad people person, how are they going to really get new clients if they can't connect on that first? Like, oh, should I take this guy? And then, well, this guy's giving me bad vibes. So, that's like, it. I'm not going to pick them because they get, and the bad vibe is not something somebody might actually put down. They might not even tell them that they gave them bad vibes. So they won't even know. And so that softer skill is really important, which I think sometimes we lose that. Yeah. And I think it's really important you pressed that, you pointed that out.
It needs a new name. Because these are not things that are easy to develop, right? Like it's easier to teach somebody content, but have you ever tried to make somebody more friendly or more empathetic or a better communicator? It's really hard.
Yeah. that's a very hard thing. I mean, it's kind of like people skills. People always talk about that. Like it's very... It is esoteric. Like, how do you figure out how you're going to be that person? It's a lot of work. Like, if you come from somebody that was very shy, not able to express themselves, and suddenly they kind of blossom and they figure it out, you know, even when they figure it out, they may try to teach other people, but it's always kind of like a secret sauce. It's like, can you actually relay that? Or is it kind of tied to your individual, like where you are? Like if you haven't gotten beyond your imposter syndrome or your trauma, it might be hard for you to get that if you don't deal with other things. Mm-hmm. Just from my, just taking a kind of idea, maybe that's what the problem is at a high level.
Yeah, there are lots of things happening. I don't think this modern workplace is straightforward.
Yeah, it's interesting, everything that we've talked about. I do want to mention before we leave, like your website again. And if you could tell people, like if they click on that, what happens when they click on your site? What do they see there?
Well, of course, you'll see a link where you can buy the book, whether it's print, digital, or audio. But on the website, there's also links to all my social profiles. I share content all the time, things that should help people get ahead, whether it's career related, leadership related, small business related. And there's links to all kinds of podcast interviews I've done. So, you know, you don't have to buy the book. There's tons of resources. Of course, I don't mind when people buy the book, but there's also other resources.
Yeah. Well, we do encourage people to buy your book and hope people will click on this link. As I said, they're fully clickable. We are on all the major podcast platforms where you can listen to or watch podcasts, and you'll be able to click through on that through resilientcareer.com. For those of you on audio, if you go to any of the sites like Apple or Spotify or Google, iHeartRadio, you'll be able to click through on that link. Those are just a couple of the platforms that we're on. I want to thank you again for being a guest on the Family Like It Goes podcast, and hope you have a good night.
All right. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.